I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Urban farming is something that we've talked about a lot on this program, and there are a lot of questions about it. Can it really feed our people? Is it just a pie-in-the-sky thing? People are doing it all over the place. Can you really make a business out of it? Can people sustain it without foundations? And there are also just great stories that go along with it. We have urban farms here in Baltimore. They have urban farms across the country. We've interviewed so many people from Milwaukee, Oakland. Right now, coming through town, speaking at the Ina Pratt Free Library, will be Novella Carpenter. She's author of a book called Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer. And she's an urban farmer in Oakland and has written a very funny, witty book about, it's more than just funny, witty, it's got substance as well, about her life there. And Novella, good to have you in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And sitting over here as well is Brian Leggett, who's a co-founder and CEO of Big City Farms, which plans to create a network of citywide urban farming operations beginning here in Baltimore. Urban greenhouses will grow organic, nutrient-dense produce and deliver it locally, ultra-locally, as they say. And I should do a disclaimer, Brian Leggett's also a member of the board of directors of the Center for Emerging Media, which produces this show. So that's not why he's here, though. Good to see you, Brian.
Wonderful to be here. Thanks, Mark.
So, Novella, let's talk about this. I love the way this the sojourn you went on with the man who looks like he has watermelons under his arm to find the right city.
I know my poor, long-suffering boyfriend, right? I describe him as like a man that looks like he's carrying water.
He's passing up. He's a big guy, and he's...
He's just kind of burly.
Burly guy.
He works on cars for a living, so it's just sort of how he does it. But yeah, so we...
this is a great description. I've never heard him described quite that way, and I like that description.
Thanks. yeah, so we moved from Seattle. Bill and I met in Seattle, and then we moved to Oakland about 7 years ago now, and set up shop and got right to farming.
But in a small plot.
Yeah, a small plot, a tenth of an acre. And you know, I was sort of into growing vegetables and raising bees at the time, and chickens. I had done that in Seattle. And as I moved to the Bay Area, I just realized that, I don't know, there's something about the Bay Area. You can just be a total freak, you know?
It
just
is true.
Like, take it to the limit, you know what I mean? And so I ran with it, and I started raising my own meat birds. I started raising turkey for Thanksgiving.
So you're not a vegetarian?
I'm not a vegetarian. People oftentimes, you know, think, oh, she's kind of a hippie from Berkeley or something. I'm just like, whatever, I'm slaughtering turkeys in my backyard in Oakland. Thank you very much. So, yeah, kind of a different scene.
Well, yeah, right. You eat vegetarians.
Yeah, but yes, that's true. Although, you know what? Technically, chickens and pigs, they're omnivorous.
They are omnivorous. Mm, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They'll eat anything that you put in front of them.
Yeah, yeah. Chicken will eat meat.
Mm-hmm. So going back to this plot of land you have.
Yeah.
In all seriousness, why did you end up choosing Oakland instead of like any other city, A or B, moving into the country?
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, to answer the first question, why not just move to the country? Because people ask me that all the time, like, wow, why would you want to grow food in the city? And partially it's because my parents already did that and I have to rebel. You know, you can't be like your parents.
My parents were a farm girl.
My parents were back to the land hippies in Idaho. And so I never had that sort of romantic vision of the country. I knew the real dirt and it was not pretty.
Was it a commune or an individual
farm?
It
wasn't a commune, but it was sort of like a very loose-knit, you know,
right,
group of people.
I know those places.
You know.
Yeah, I do know.
Yeah. They built their own house. And then
right.
I was like, Mom, did you have a permit to do that? Oh, no, of course not. You know, it was like, oh, great. But anyway, so I had sort of – I didn't have a romantic notion of the country. And mm-hmm. I grew up in a rural area. You know, I don't like rural areas necessarily. I find them kind of boring. So the great thing about farming in this city is that you have nightlife and Chinese restaurants and all these ethnic groups and all this stuff. So I love cities. But then from just an environmental perspective, if you are growing your food, you go and cut it yourself and bring it into your house. There's no refrigerated trucks. It's really close by. So it becomes this this way of living closer to nature and not using, petroleum to get your food around. So, yeah.
Well, tell us about your neighborhood.
Oh, yeah. So we moved to the neighborhood, Ghost Town, which is kind of a forlorn part of Oakland. in that it's, you know, abandoned buildings and, you know, houses that are boarded up and vacant lots. And the apartment we moved into had a vacant lot right next door to it. Nobody knew who owned it. It had been vacant for years and years and years. People had used it as a, you know, a parking lot and a trash disposal. There were weeds growing everywhere. And when I looked at it, I thought, wow, I can really grow some food there. It was a big piece of, I mean, you know, for me, a tenth of an acre is actually kind of big. And especially in California, it is too.
So big for what?
It's just large. It's large enough that you could actually grow pretty intense. You could do a pretty intensive vegetable production.
For yourself?
For myself, but also for my neighbors. And as that lot has become more and more, it's really intense, you know, planting. So really, really tightly planted things in rows that are always constantly being harvested. You can actually grow enough food for, like, I mean, for me, I grow for probably about four different families in the neighborhood.
And because of the climate in Oakland, you can grow
year-round.
Year-round.
Yeah,
right?
It's year-round. You're right. And I mean, you know, I have like a lime tree and orange trees and, you know, there's lots of citrus and I have a banana tree. So it's, you know, it's true. Don't hate me because I live in California. But it is a nice,
nice
climate. Yeah.
I love California.
It's good for growing.
Yeah. It's good for lots of things.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's good for lots of things, California. Also growing lots of things. But the sojourn you took in kind of bringing these, not just vegetable gardening, but you describe going out and buying pigs and raising these pigs and the certain kinds. And talk a bit about that.
Okay, well.
And how that, and how you and your neighbors got on with that.
Oh, right, right, right. Well, you know, what's interesting about having a farm in the city is it becomes, and I never thought this would happen. You can't think of this until you build the farm in the city.
Right.
Is that it becomes a conversation piece for everyone. You know, I have people stop by the farm constantly to tell me their story. Like, I'm from Nigeria and I have goats just like you have, you know.
And as a matter of fact, part of your story.
Yeah, I mean, I have, yeah, there's always people.
But we'll get to that in a minute about your Nigerian goats.
Yeah, we'll get to that. That'll be good. I love talking about the goats. Or, you know, people be like, here's how you slaughter a pig. You know, I'm from the South, and this is how Daddy used to do it, you know. So really intense stories about food production, just because I'm there at the farm, you know, hanging out, doing my thing. So those are that's part of what I didn't realize would be part of having a farm. In terms of the pigs, Bill and I were very motivated by pork. I'm not going to lie to you. We love bacon. And so that was part of what we really wanted to go see, if we could raise our own bacon, you
but
know?
Without nitrates, right?
Without nitrates, without anything. And,
right.
So, you know, totally organic and, you know, and P.S., we were just going to raise them on dumpstered food. So we would go to very high-end fancy restaurants, go through their dumpsters, you know, where there was lots of food waste. And this is part of living in a city, right? There's, you know, you don't finish your whole pizza.
Right.
And so our idea was that we would, you know, go find this food, feed it to pigs, and then we would have bacon.
And
it worked out. It was fine.
So, was that the first time you slaughtered a pig?
Well, I actually didn't slaughter the pig. I had it done by a woman who I hired. And it didn't go, that particular part was not good. What was, you know, for me, what was great about raising the pigs was they converted all this waste food into food for me. And they grew to this enormous size. They were like 300
Huge.
Pounds each. They were crazy. And, you know, they would sometimes escape and then my neighbors would have to help me like round them back up into the pen. And so we've really created sort of oddly this bond between the community.
Because your neighbors wanted the bacon as well.
No, they were vegetarian Buddhist monks. I don't know
why. The Buddhist monk lived across the street who made
why
that watermelon soup
me?
Or whatever he made.
Yeah,
right, right,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
Right,
so
right.
I don't know why they were helping me, but I think they, you know, it was just part of the deal. And so the part with where the woman actually slaughtered the pigs was a downside. I felt bummed about it. It was a USDA slaughter facility, and it was just she didn't do it. You know, she just didn't do what I wanted to do, which was to be there and to watch and make sure that, you know, these pigs that I had raised for 6 months
weren't going to suffer.
I wanted to be there. But anyway, I have a blog, and someone wrote to me, and they're like, Novella, because I was, you know, talking about this lady and how much I hated her. They're like, Novella, you know what? This isn't about that anymore. This is about you creating pork products now. So focus. And I'm like, they're right. So I went and made awesome bacon. I had actually met a chef in the dumpster at one of these fine restaurants in Berkeley, who was an Italian trained butcher. And so he trained me how to make prosciutto and coppa and pancetta and all these Italian dry cured meats. So, you know, because what was I going to do with that much pork at one time? That's a huge windfall. And so that part was really satisfying for me.
So it's always hard. The pig part is hard just because they're so smart.
Yeah.
I mean, you get sheep and cows are often fairly stupid. They're not bright animals.
Right.
They feel, but they're not bright. But pigs are smart.
They are smart. Goats are smart. And I mean, I don't know. I think, yeah, it's a tough call. But, you know, for the pigs, I was so exhausted from feeding them. I mean, at the end, we were feeding them 9 buckets every single day.
You still have some?
Of the pork?
The pigs.
I have one thing of pig's feet in my
freezer. You're not raising pigs
anymore. Not raising pigs anymore.
What made you stop raising pigs?
Because that amount of work.
Right.
And because after Bill and I had all this pork on our hands, you know, we'd have lavish parties and try to get rid of the pork.
I wish I knew you then.
Well, yeah, I know. A lot of people were like, oh, my God, I love novella. But then what happened is we gained tons of weight. We were just eating like pigs. Like, it was sick. And so, you know, I don't think I wouldn't do it again. Unless I was doing it with a group of people, maybe. That's when I would do it.
Talk about your Nigerian goats.
Yeah, so I decided after the pigs, you know, I needed another project. But I had been sort of getting a little bit sick of just, you know, raising animals to eat them. I kind of felt like the witch in Hansel and Gretel, you know. I was like constantly like, is that one ready? And so I thought, you know, Exactly. Isn't that terrible?
Right, right.
And so I thought, you know, the one way I can really have a connection is to have a milk goat. And I knew this guy who was raising goats in Berkeley. And so he taught me a little bit about how to do it. And so I jumped on. I bought a Nigerian dwarf goat. She was pregnant. She gave birth on my farm. And it was this amazing experience. And then to be able to milk her and have fresh milk every day. And then I've started making cheese. It's just
this particular goat, though, had a milk was different.
Her
right?
milk, yeah, well, Nigerian dwarf goats have a great percentage of fat. It's 8% butter fat. So it's like cream on the top milk, you know. It's just amazing. And I've just I just adore goats, too. They're just such smart creatures.
Are. So you don't slaughter these goats?
No, we don't slaughter them, although sometimes what happens is you breed your Nigerian dwarf goat. She gives birth, and she has a male. And with the male goats,
you can't milk males.
You can't milk males. little lesson that people don't know about.
So no milking your meat.
Yeah. So that's when, we call.
Well, that's not very fair to the male goat.
What's
I'm
that?
Just kidding.
Yeah. Well, I know all the males on the. You know, it's sad because we can't have roosters and you can't have male goats. But yeah, and so our solution for that particular instance was to find our local liquor store owner, who happened to be a goat farmer from Yemen, and he came over and did the deed.
And Islamic slaughtering is very different than.
It was beautiful.
Yeah,
I
experienced
amazing.
That's a very to watch, just having to look into the animal's eye and.
Yeah.
Before you slaughter
yeah.
it, and then it's like kosher, but it's
yeah.
but it's really different.
Right, and he brought his wife, and she sang a song.
Right.
And the kids were there, and it was just like a really intense meat moment, you know?
And it's almost, if there's such a thing as a gentle way of slaughter.
Yeah.
The Islamic slaughtering is that.
It is. Yeah.
This is not just an experiment. This is something that clearly from what you've written in your world, this is your way of life.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You refer to it as a farm.
Yeah, it's normal, you know. I've got, like, you know, dirty boots and, you know, just kind of wandering around. And I actually start another farm in San Lorenzo now, which is just outside of Oakland. And I take Bart there to farm. You know, it's hilarious. Sometimes I'll have some alfalfa with me in my bag. And I'm just, like, getting on the commuter train, you know. So it's just what I do. And there's more and more people that are doing it.
Well, I mean, You're a delightful writer.
Thank you.
And the experience is very important, what you're kind of telling us about what we can do. But I'm curious, and let me bring Brian, since he was so nice to come by and I know he's an aficionado of all this, wants to try to create something here in Baltimore. But I'm curious what you both think about really the viability of urban farming. I mean, it's – you have – I mean, I know other people in town who farm. I know people, you know, we can grow our own vegetables and do things like that. And I can't grow animals to slaughter because Valerie would leave me. But but
good for her.
But almost every major operation, whether it's, you know, Growing Power, People's Grocery, Will Allen's thing, Growing Power, and all that stuff, that even the largest of them cannot sustain themselves. They have to get grants to make it work. Mm-hmm. People cannot make a go of the business. And if that's A. Let me just start there, because I mean, because there are other questions that grow out of that. But I mean, mm-hmm. other than what you do, which is great, and what people can grow their own,
yeah,
is it really viable beyond that to feed communities?
I hope so. That's what my partners and I, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs and farmers across the country are at least looking at and trying to do, come up with what the model should look like. We look at it this way. A lot of the things that have been tried, they've been tried to prove something in an extremely positive way, and they've come at it from a very holistic standpoint. So it's bees, it's meat, it's eggs, it's all types of produce, berries, fruit, to try to show that all of these things can happen. And in many ways, there's a lot of synergy between a lot of those things, the bees and the plants, for instance. And they're composting and they're doing all the things, kind of the full sustainable cycle. To do that all inside of a 1 acre or half acre or 2 acre piece of land, you're just not going to get to any type of scale. And so the efficiencies of scale are very different there. And so to duplicate what they're doing and put it in 10 locations across the city I don't think is a model that could be financially successful. However, if you could create multiple companies and maybe one focuses, you know, on creating soil and all the aspects that go into creating really good soil, the composting and so on and the collection and so on, and you could create somebody that focuses on the produce and maybe somebody's focusing on meats or eggs or something, and they could be in similar plots of land, but there's an expertise that's there. And you're doing this with two thoughts. One is that let me give our model as an example. Our model is in order to overcome what seems like an impossible kind of business here at a local level, we're looking at dozens of sites in one city, all linked together on an IT system. And information, we think, is extremely important because you can't supply large contracts. And it's in these sustainable large contracts over a long period of time that someone can get to a place where they can plan and grow more than they thought they might otherwise be able to risk. And in that is where your profit is. If you can't risk, you can't make profit. And so if someone has 2 acres right now, and we can come to them and say, you can expand to 4 acres, and they're like, I don't know how to go do that. Well, they can't go do that because they can't supply the large contracts consistently, and so those large contracts have to go to Salinas or someplace else to bring this food in. And so for us, what we're saying is let's create these small farm plots all over the place. Let's say there are a couple acres and there's a couple dozen of them, and integrate. We know exactly what's going on with RFID and barcodes and every carrot and every head of lettuce and so on and where it is so that we can supply a large contract to a Whole Foods or a Bon Appetit Food Services or somebody like that. And by doing that, we can bring confidence to the retailer. But for the small farmer, they don't understand legal contracts typically in many cases. They don't understand or have a lot of experience with marketing and sales and branding and operations, supply chain management. How do you cut out that nickel here and that penny here? And for a very reasonable margin, one that is very typical around the country for things like this, they could sell and maybe leave a 20 to 25% margin in for the aggregator that they could own a piece of. And then that aggregator can do all of these kind of larger contract sales and go in after the school, like this, the city public school system is a $40 million food budget. It's very difficult as a small farmer to get to that. But if you aggregated with a bunch of other farmers, you'd be an expert at what you do and go after those larger contracts. We do think that there's a solution there.
How does that sound to you?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm always approaching it from a much smaller scale, of course. And I see people who are successful doing that. For instance, beekeepers. There's a place called Marshall's Bees in California. And they basically just put beehives in different little local people's backyards. And then they harvest it and sell it and make a pretty good profit. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at certain operations, certain parts of my farm make money. Bees, rabbits, microgreens, that kind of thing. For me, I don't want to just be a microgreen grower. You know what I mean? Like, that would be, like, the worst scene for me is, like, all I do is grow lettuce and, like, forget the animals and all of that. And having said that, but, you know, Brian talking about, you know, tackling the school program, school food lunch program, I don't have time to do that. Most people don't. I don't have time to lobby all the forces and powers that be that actually control that food, the school lunch programs. And that food is horrible. And so it does need to be changed. So things like that, that makes me excited.
Then we have as long as he's here, I hope he stays here, we have a head of our, Tom Gerassi, who's head of our school food program, is turning it around to try to do those things. He just needs more support than he's getting, I think, from the school system, mm-hmm. some other places to make it happen. But, okay, I have a question.
And there's one other aspect. One other aspect that I think is really important, and that's in – I've been in a lot of different industries, various consumer products, healthcare, e-learning. One of the things that's consistent that I see across these is as industries morph, where people find their margin as a business, right? I think we're looking in the wrong place. Everyone's looking to make money growing something. I think that's the problem. The money is in redefining the distribution system, and that's what we're focused on. Instead of having a tomato come from Salinas through a three-tiered distribution system with 7 days of waste and lost nutrition and refrigeration and handling and loss and all these things, if you make it in an ultra-local fashion, it's not just that I'm eliminating maybe that 40 cents of retail dollar wasted on that supply chain, because I'm going to be more expensive than Salinas is to grow it, right? So they may only be 60 cents of the dollar. I might be 75 cents of the dollar. But I still have 25 cents in there. If I can distribute that for 10 cents, I've got 15 cents in there. And I'm doing this in a way that allows me, I can then go into the grocery store and walk into a Whole Foods, for instance, and say, I will put the lettuce on the shelf for another 10 cents. They can't do that in Salinas. And I'm going to do it. You're going to actually see the lettuce because I'm right down the street. And so we're going to have a contract here. I'll supply from someplace else if I can't, but we're going to try to grow what you need right here, and we're going to try to bring it there every morning. Well, so there's a whole set of margins in there that were not available before.
Maybe this is an unbridgeable gap I'm about to raise. Right? But I understand, you know, for all of our conversations, Brian, what you're talking about in big city farms. And I understand what you're talking about, Novella Carpenter, because I've done that and I've been part of those movements rurally and in this urban area seeing things happen. But the gap is, who are we feeding? I mean, if we're selling it to Whole Foods, it's a good business, but who are we feeding?
Great question.
Problem is, people can't afford decent food.
Right.
And so, you know, I might choose when I look for my organic vegetables to go to, and I'm not endorsing folks, this is public media, but I might choose to go to Wegmans because it's cheaper than going to Whole Foods, which is like Whole Paychecks, and you can't get out of there. Where I can buy a bunch of carrots at organic for a dollar less than I can buy them somewhere else, let's say. Or regular people. I think it was it in your book? I just read this, or the article I just read. I think it was in the article I just read, not your book. We're in Oakland. Mm-hmm. There's no supermarket for here. It is right here. That not a single grocery store exists in West Oakland, a neighborhood of about 24,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
But there are 50 corner stores,
mm-hmm.
which is about one for every 500 residents. The question is, how do we feed – can urban agriculture given that most places where you won't be like Oakland, where it's not the kind of temperate somewhere you can more than temperate where you can kind of grow all year round.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that in Baltimore unless you have greenhouses.
Right.
But can urban agriculture feed people at a price they can afford? That's the question.
Well, you know, when I mean, and this is where it becomes sort of, I think that there's room in the pool for all kinds of people to do these things, right? So I think that what Brian's describing, the big city farm idea, is kind of like what we used to, what we would call it big organic. It's like big urban ag. It's, you know, it's this idea that, okay, we're going to like figure it out, have a structure and stop, you know, because like remember back in the day when organic started, you'd like this tiny renty little artichoke, you know, some like flea beetle eating lettuce. And you're kind of like, oh, my God, what are they doing? And in some ways, that's what the last 10 years in urban agriculture has been, is people sort of like figuring out how to do it. Now, traditionally, it has been very much, you know, nonprofits who get foundation money in order to be able to sell the food. And like when I was just in Philadelphia, I met people at Greens Grow and Mill Creek and all these other places that are growing food. And they're able to offer it for an affordable price because they are often supported by nonprofit entity. And so it is kind of like subsidized food. But for me, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. If it makes people feel good, if they offer classes, you know, for the community, if it's a community building thing, then what's the problem? And then this idea of, you know, the bigger scale farming so you can sell to Whole Foods. You know, it's just a different, you're just feeding different kinds of people and everybody does need to eat. And I think that the point that you raised, which is this, where are the eaters, you know, because this is going to, you know, this is something that we have to figure out as well. In Oakland, those liquor stores, there's no fresh produce at all. It's just, you know, liquor and chips.
Right.
And then how are we going to, you know, have people eat food other than beer and chips, you know, if this is what's available. And so there's an educational component to it that really has to be, you know, people have to learn how to cook.
These are two huge legs of what we're trying to do as well with community involvement and schools. Each farm is supposed to be connected with a school and the kids come to the school. And one of the greenhouses, as we move forward, will be set aside for the kids to grow things in. And hopefully this is coordinated with Tony Geraci's academic curriculum and his vocational training and so on, and we can actually create farmers that can go out and create some more farms straight out of high school, but having been through school and prepared the food and so on. And then from a community standpoint, there would be classes and so on. I guess I look at this as this is just one of 50 ways in which we need to go about tackling the problem, and she's got a dozen others. We simply must change how food is currently done. This traveling, even across state lines, to me just doesn't make a lot of sense. And so we should be testing out every method. I do believe that there are for-profit components of this. And then there's simply a complete sea change backwards, if you will, to the way things used to be and how we would think about eating. You know, we would cut our produce that day. We would bring it in. We would get our bread from the baker that day. I think there's a strong kind of pre-tipping point movement occurring in this direction. And so we're looking at a big city farm saying, if you did dot the city with farms and people that worked the farms were from that local neighborhood and they walked there and the owner of that farm was from the neighborhood and maybe it was connected with the church or the synagogue or whatever, and then you start doing these educational and community programs, people will start to put gardens in their backyard. People will start to get away from the cans and the bags and start to say, oh, a tomato isn't just ketchup.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
Okay, we're going to say something.
I was just going to say there's a program that I saw in Philadelphia that's doing that, and it's called Uni, and it's Philadelphia has this great program where it's a nutritional mandate, so it's kind of like, you know, you get funding from the government, and they have kids from high schools come and work in the gardens with the idea that the children would then go home and tell their parents, like, hey, here's how you cook ratatouille or whatever, you know, something like that. Yeah.
So it's a combination of these. This what you've been writing about and what you've been talking about here, Brian Leggett. And once again, we're talking about urban farming here for a piece of this program. And we're lucky that Novella Carpenter, who wrote Farm City, the Education of an Urban Farmer, is in Baltimore today. And we snatched her on the way to the library to give her presentation this evening down at the Central Branch. And Brian Leggett, who's co-founder and CEO of Big City Farms. And a couple of things. I mean, I wonder when I was looking at this article again that was in the article about urban farming that I was reading before we did the show together was in Earth Island Journal. And the article is talking about whether or not urban agriculture can really sustain itself. And they focused a lot of attention on Oakland and what's going on in West Oakland, an area you know well, Melville.
Yeah.
And what it said here, in 2008 study found that West Oakland residents spend around $54 million annually for food that they consume at home. $54 million.
It's a huge market.
But that's mostly a working class community we're talking about in West Oakland. It's not, which is the poor end of Oakland. And a lot of that money, at least 68% of that money or more, is lost to the local economy. And most of it's, you know, food brought out or is this crappy food just you get from those corner stores you're talking about, Novella. And so the question is, what I'm interested in is A, whether we think that can be transformed realistically. Because I would challenge one thing. I'm not so sure we can survive just on the food grown in our backyards.
I don't think so either.
I mean, people want oranges. We can't grow oranges in your backyard. Then oranges are going to come from California or Florida or some other place.
And you're not going to grow wheat in your front yard either. You know, like we need farmers who are growing grains and those kinds of things out in rural areas.
And that's, that gets shipped into us wherever we happen to be.
Yeah.
So the question is, how can we create, do you think, urban farming or suburban farming or farming in metropolitan areas that actually can sustain an economy, pay the people who are doing it, and feed people at reasonable prices, not at places like Bon Appetit and Home Food, at Whole Foods, but at places where people can actually, the majority of people can actually afford to eat, because only the elite can go to those places.
Well, but it's those places that allow an operation to start so that it can expand and do those things. You know, again, where's the market today for fresh produce? If I talk to one of my mentees from my foundation in the inner city, you know, the closest that he came to a tomato again was a ketchup packet.
Right.
And so I'm not going to convince him overnight to do this. That's where Tony's work in the school system of getting these kids to put their hands on the soil and do these things is going to do that. So this is a 20-year transition. But what we can do is to start to get them involved in the vocation of this, which we'll introduce them in a different way, and dot these farms all over the place where you actually see this, and then sell, start the company, start selling it to whoever will buy it at the moment, and then expand through education and community outreach and other things this the notions that we're trying to talk about, and then hopefully over time these get absorbed and culturally change what's appropriate to eat.
And I think that, I mean, and it does take a lot, it is going to be a long transition. I think of it as a evolutionary, revolutionary kind of change. We have to have revolutionary change so the evolutionary change can take place. You know, that you really have to, have that in many ways. So, I mean, I'm curious what you think about it. Because this is your hands are in the dirt.
Right.
And you're in a poor neighborhood.
Yeah, and I do see, you know, and I do see this idea of like, and this is a another, you know, Pandora's box to open, but is, oh, we're training people to be farmers? Like, what the hell? Great, because I have three jobs. I don't know about you, but I have, you know, you don't make money farming. No, rural farmers don't make money farming, you know? Most farmers have other jobs. And I'm blessed to be a writer, and I'm able to get my work published, so I'm paid to do that. And I also run an urban farming store in a biodiesel station in Berkeley. And so I have to supplement my income. So saying like, oh, I'm going to train someone to be a farmer as a way of living is just not – that's not even a – it's not a highly regarded skill. And it's not something that will make you money. But the one thing that I do think that is good about that, because I'm working with some men that are doing work after being in prison, you know, so they have – it's like a work program for people transitioning out. And they're learning entrepreneurial skills. And so those are the things that are actually valuable. You know, figure out a way to, you know, learn farming, learn how it works, learn that there's also – this is like running a business as well. And so from that you can glean something and then start another job. So it's this like whole thing where like are we really – do we – I want children to know about good food and eating good food, but we can't all be farmers.
Right.
And we can't afford to all be farmers either unless we all start paying huge amounts of money for our food.
Exactly. And I think so. But this is – I mean, so this is kind of – I think it's a discussion – we're having here for a half an hour or 40 minutes, that really has to be an ongoing, longer discussion about how we transform things, how we change them. We've had this great idea about, you know, Will Allen and all those guys doing great stuff. I love Will Allen and what he's doing, and people like him in Baltimore and Milwaukee and Philadelphia and Chicago and Oakland or wherever that is, People's Grocery in Oakland. But the discussion has to start now about how you take this 20-year change to change who we are and get those things moving, you know, I mean, and get that to become a reality in our midst.
I think there's also, stepping back and thinking about this, it's the whole food thing. The school cafeteria is a perfect microcosm to kind of discuss the food cycle. What Tony's trying to do is not just create a bunch of farmers. In fact, that's probably the last thing that he thinks about. He thinks about processing. He thinks about cooking. He thinks about all these other things where right now, or before he came in there, they would have a pizza, you know, would be delivered, or whatever it was getting delivered in a can. They opened it up, or in a big bin. They opened it up, and they dumped it out on a tray, and they warmed it up or chilled it. And that was it. And so it was essentially a glorified server for the person in the kitchen. A real job, though, could be, again, Bon Appetit does this, where they buy local stuff as much as they can, and they actually make it right there, and then they serve it. That same thing could transform the entire school system, create a tremendous number of jobs. And to me, one of the most important things that comes out of that is just a completely different learning experience.
Mm-hmm. But if you took your model and you translate that model into providing for locally owned stores to sell to people in their communities. I mean, there's a model here to be built economically.
I hope that happens.
But that's the only way, to me, it makes sense. I mean, I don't care about feeding the rich.
Totally.
I care about feeding the people. The model that can be built that can be driven by a market that feeds people, I think is what we're talking about here.
Let me throw in one thing. I think that's exactly correct, that's a huge component piece of this. I think it's a natural, like water going downhill, natural progression of hopefully what we're trying to do here. There are acres and acres and acres of land in every city. 30,000 empty lots in this city, 90 square miles or something of effective land in Detroit that's got nothing on it. Most of this land has no better use for decades. It's either next to a train track or it's got some chemicals in the ground or there's just something else that's negative from a retail consumer or whatever. And so that land has no better use. It's going to be vacant. All the cities have control over much of this land. They can give it to all these people that want to do this. You have free land. If you have someone that can help you horticulturally and microbiologically and set you up with what we're doing, which is the cheapest possible greenhouse you can make. It's plastic over steel tubes. We've got no electricity. We know how to do 11
hoop
months
houses.
Out of the year. Hoop houses.
Right.
And so the structure that we're doing is the lowest possible asset cost, free land. Now, you don't even pay taxes on the land because it's a 100-year lease. And you can go in there and you can grow greens, and hopefully you can grow some microgreens and get a higher price or whatever it may be, but you create the specialty crop based on what's there, sell some to Whole Foods or sell some to the school system through an aggregator and take and triple the size of your farm and open up a store and do a whatever. This is going to have 20 heads. The initial thing that we're talking about doing is just a small piece of this, but it's let's start grabbing land and turning it into an agricultural purpose and then start to let things happen based on the entrepreneurial spirit of the people in the city.
And it can happen. 30 years ago, we had a People's Grocery Store, we called it, People's Free Grocery Store in Waverly. We fed the neighborhood by buying inexpensive food in bulk and selling it. It wasn't into healthy food back then. We were just selling food in bulk to feed a working-class neighborhood. And it worked. I mean, the model's there if we want to make it work. We've got to figure out ways combining these things that actually happen. Novella, close this out for us. In your thoughts about where this is, the story about yourself and the place that you're building and where you think we're going.
Just to piggyback on what Brian was saying is I know people – I mean, this isn't an either-or situation. I know there's a lot of controversy, actually, about corporations coming in and taking over city land to grow food for profit. It's huge. It's a huge issue. However, I do think that there is probably enough room for everyone. And from the people that I know, there's this great guy, Hank Herrera, who is working on that same project. It's your project, but it's Brian's project, but it's, you know, just for the people. It's like, we're going to make it low cost and we're going to take EBT cards and all this stuff. So, you know, it's just in the air. It's just part of what we need. We are realizing that our food system is broken. And how am I personally going to change it? For Brian, he's an entrepreneur. That's what he's going to do. For my friend Hank, he's a social justice activist, pioneer, amazing person. He's going to go do it. For me, I'm going to keep teaching people, which is what I love to do. Because honestly, I feel like what happens when you have organizations, nonprofits, corporations, there's a breakdown there. But if you have one person and your core thing is to know how to grow your own food, how to, you know, kill a chicken if you need to, how to milk a goat, those are the things that are going to change your life. They're going to change the lives of your children and then their grandchildren. And so for me, it's just a really personal thing. And it's not about money. And, you know, it's just I just do it by any means necessary.
Well, Novella Carbonell, it's been a joy to have you in the studio and meet you.
Thank you.
I look forward to seeing you at your place
Thanks.
In Oakland.
Yeah, come by.
When we're next there. The book is Farm City, The Education of an Urban Farmer, Novella Carpenter, who speaks tonight at the Enoch Pratt Central Branch at 7 p.m. We urge you to go down and have a conversation with your fellows and friends about all this in our community. She's here for this evening. And Brian Leggett, a good friend, co-founder and CEO of Big City Farms, and as I said, also a member of our board here at Center for Emerging Media, but that's not why he's here. Brian, thank you so much as well.
Thank you for having me. Wonderful.
All right. Thank you. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Marianne Amos. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.